Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The state long-term care ombudsman is receiving grant money to help nursing homes better care for dementia patients. It's going to be through a person-centered approach. We're going to unpack all of that for you. Joining us now is the state long-term care ombudsman for Ohio, Erin Pettigrew. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Let's talk about what the issues are, for starters, with nursing homes and people who have dementia. What's the problem?
Well, one of the basic problems is that there's just so many of them, so many people now coming down with symptoms of dementia, being diagnosed with either Alzheimer's disease or one of the other spectrum of dementias. So facilities are trying to work with folks and their physical health and now their brain health, and trying to keep them healthy and give them a quality of life and give them good medical care, and ensuring that their staff are properly trained to know how to work with people with dementia so that we all benefit.
So there's more of it.
Yes, absolutely.
What Ohio's do we know about how much?
Well, it's really hard to unpack. We're not really sure how many people have dementia because it can start in our brain so much earlier than we're actually diagnosed. It's really hard to put our finger on it. And so now they're estimating over 200,000 people in Ohio are diagnosed with dementia. But that number could be much higher when you look at the people who have early onset, or I'm sorry, early stages of diseases.
And, you know, you hear about the memory units and that kind of thing and nursing homes, but there aren't enough to manage that.
No. And most homes, really, even if they have a specialized memory care unit, many other people in the home have memory impairments. And so there's cognitive impairments throughout the home. And so those memory care units are often very specialized for folks who are in a certain stage of that disease.
More of a profound stage of it.
Uh-huh. Right, right.
We're talking about long-term care for people with dementia. In the state of Ohio. My guest is Erin Pettigrew. She's the state long-term care ombudsman for Ohio. They recently received a grant to help with this issue. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Erin, I feel like you're someone I ought to have on a regular basis.
I'd be happy
because to. It's there are more and more older people in Ohio and the country writ large. We're an aging population. And so that means you're kind of in a full employment sort of a job.
Job security is very safe in the healthcare industry when we're working with elders. That's for sure.
Right. What is the grant going to do?
So we applied for a grant that is managed by the Ohio Department of Medicaid with the Centers for Medicare and Medicare Services at the federal level. This money is actually fines that nursing homes have paid when they violated regulations. And so they might be fined for a citation of harm to a resident. And so that money goes into a pot, and we can use it pretty creatively. So we can use it for innovative things that improve resident care. So many groups have applied for different grants, and we've been very successful over the years in getting some of these grant funds. The one that we were recently awarded is to help cut the amount of people on antipsychotic medications who shouldn't be by providing better dementia care. And so we are partnered with the Eden Alternative, which is a internationally known group that works to improve the care offered to people living with dementia so that caregivers aren't reaching for pills to try to manage difficult behaviors, so to speak.
Why would antipsychotic medications come into play with someone who has dementia?
Well, some of the outbursts that you might see with somebody with some profound symptoms of dementia, some of the restlessness, wanting to walk unaccompanied out of the building, putting themselves in danger, some of those things are behaviors that the facilities aren't quite capable of handling. They don't have enough staff, or the staff aren't properly trained. And so one of the effects of these antipsychotics is to mute those behaviors and make people calmer, a little more docile, helping them to rest. So although that sounds good, those medications can be very dangerous for people with dementia. They're very good for people who have certain diagnoses. So if you've got Huntington's disease or some of the very serious mental illnesses, those antipsychotics are wonderful and they've done wonderful things for them. But for those who are elderly with dementia, it can be deadly. They've got a black box warning on them. So we don't want people reaching for those pills in lieu of good dementia care.
And what does good dementia care look like?
Good dementia care is reading the person and knowing their triggers, knowing what they like and don't like, having time to gently do the tasks that we need to do. People with dementia still need to brush their teeth. They still need to take baths. They still need to eat, get exercise. And so a caregiver who knows that person and knows what time of day that's best, knows to approach them for their favorite foods, knows to get them walking when they're antsy late in the afternoon. So good dementia care can help alleviate some of those symptoms that otherwise might trigger an outburst.
Are there enough people working in the industry, employed, I should say, to do what needs to be done with this growing challenge?
I think universally we agree there are not enough people in the field. So direct caregivers, the aides who work in the homes or the people who go out on home care visits and visit with people in the community, we don't believe that there are enough of them. So attracting them, paying them a good wage, training them, mentoring them, and then retaining them has been a real focus, both on the industry side and for those of us who are advocates.
The wages are a big problem. That's at the core of attracting them in the first place, right?
It is, but it's also offering a quality work environment. So staff being supported. So yes, if we doubled the salary of an aide, we'd have better retention. Absolutely. The industry will argue that they're not paid enough to do that. Mm-hmm. But we also think that there can be things in between. There can be mentoring. There can be good career tracks. And so as part of our state plan on aging, the Ohio Department of Aging has been working on that for many months. We're going to be working over the next few years to make sure that that's a viable career field.
What kind of training goes into this?
The training that we're going to be offering to the nursing home staff, Eden Alternative has brought in some good trainers. We're going to be meeting the first week of December, actually, to start training staff at nursing homes. So we've got a team of people from the nursing home, a trainer, some direct care people, some leaders in that home, and talk to them about what good dementia care is, what I was just talking about, and then teaching them how to teach the rest of the staff in the home. So this training, if a facility were to hire Eden Alternative individually to come in and do this training, would be probably a lot of money. But we're offering it a very low amount because it is grant supported. And the homes can come in and really learn how they can take it back to the home and train the rest of their staff so that they're fully supported in working with people.
So you're looking at taking somebody from every home kind of a thing. Someone is working in different, assisted living facilities, independent living facilities.
Unfortunately, this grant, because it's supported by that special fund, is only for the Medicaid and Medicare certified nursing homes. So, but a lot of our homes are on a campus. So you've got assisted living under the same roof or on the same campus as the nursing homes that we're affecting. So even though we're only limited to 100 nursing homes, we feel like the reach will be much greater because we've got cross-training opportunities and we've got sort of downstream training. So even new staff who aren't even hired yet, they may not even be out of high school yet, are going to benefit from people at the home being better trained on person-centered care.
Are there other states, model states, that kind of a thing, or that you're patterning this from?
Well, Eden has done this project in several other states. We've added to it. It's a much more elaborate project than they did in other states. But some other states have done similar projects. And in fact, we've done other projects that we felt were beneficial to to dementia care in general. We had a music and memory project where more than 400 nursing homes were trained on using personalized music, because that is one thing that can help soothe someone with dementia,
right,
is triggering those old memories and
right,
those good songs that
yeah,
that
we've talked about that on Wellness Wednesday before. What about people, aides? Who works most with people in nursing homes in this setting? It's not nurses.
Right. Nurses are often they're working on assessments. They're working on restorative care. They're doing evaluations.
Medications.
Right. The care planning meetings. So the people who are right there with the residents are the aides. And so they're probably our least valued financially, but mm-hmm, the most valuable when it comes to those personal relationships. They really get to know the residents that they're working with.
Are you going to be teaching them to teach others, or are you teaching somebody above them to teach them?
Well, one of the facets of the grant that I think Eden Alternative is very good at is teaching people who work in the nursing home how to facilitate and how to train. So we're not only teaching them the principles, but we're teaching them how to share that knowledge with the direct care staff, so that because we have high turnover in direct care staff, they can keep that training going long after we're done with this grant.
And let's talk a little bit more about what the hallmarks of that kind of care are. You're saying slowing things down, mm-hmm, understanding and learning more about this all takes time.
It does. It does. And one of the most important things for direct care staff is to be consistently assigned to the residents they care for. So although we have a lot of turnover, but what we'd like to see is that the same aides are assigned to the same residents day in and day out so they can know them well. And the same principles go with families in home care or staff in assisted living, is that we know the residents well enough to know what time of day is good for them, mm-hmm, what their favorite foods are, what they're doing and what they're meaning behind some of their activities. Sometimes people are looking for their shoes and we're like, well, you don't need your shoes. You're not going anywhere. Well, that's what they want, is that independence that shoes represent to them.
Mm-hmm. They like their purse.
Their purse.
Even though they don't need
example.
A purse for anything. So, you know, what kind of advice do you give families as they're looking for the right? And we know it's Medicaid funded, so they're somewhat limited. But when they're looking for the right kind of place for their loved one?
Well, they can use our long-term care consumer guide website, and that's hosted through the Ohio Department of Aging, to look for homes that have high satisfaction. So we do a satisfaction survey in nursing homes and assisted living every year. They can look for high satisfaction. They can look for homes with good quality measures so that they're providing good quality clinical care. But they have to visit. Absolutely have to visit. They
and what
have
kind
to
of questions
that.
Should they ask, or what should they be looking for in that visit? It can be kind of overwhelming.
Absolutely. They should watch for interactions between staff and residents. Staff aren't talking over residents' heads. They're interacting with them. They're engaging them, that they know their names, that staff seem pleasant and work well together. Feel free to talk to families who are visiting. I don't think a single family member would begrudge someone asking, what's been your experiences here? What's the turnover? Do the same people take care of mom every day? You can ask the administrator that, or the admissions person, you know, what's your turnover? What's your how many aides do you have on staff at night? You know, ask those questions that seem a little intrusive, but they're very good for you.
And then the holidays are coming up. Mm-hmm. What can families do for their loved ones who are in a nursing home? What do you recommend?
Absolutely visit. Sure. Family members in nursing homes are free to come home for a visit if they're able. If they're not, bring some of the festivities there. Call ahead, ask if you're uncomfortable or you're visiting someone you haven't seen in a while, talk to their caregivers. What's a good time of day?
Okay.
Maybe come in with smaller groups. Don't come in with the entire family and all the screaming kids. Come in, talk about familiar topics. You know, try to engage that person. And if the person's dementia is such that they are not able to communicate very well, sitting and talking, brushing someone's hair, holding their hand, sharing a little bit of that joy is wonderful. Even if they don't seem responsive, it's a connection there that we feel that they're still getting.
Erin Pettigrew, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
That's Erin Pettigrew. She is the state long-term care ombudsman for Ohio. They recently received a grant to help nursing homes better care for dementia patients through a more person-centered approach. You can check out the Ohio Department of Aging website for advice on what to look for when it comes to nursing homes in Ohio. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The number of married or same-gender couples in the U.S. has increased by 45% between 2008 and 2014, but little is known about why their health still tends to lag behind that of other American groups. Last month, Ohio State, along with Bowling Green State University, were selected to shed some light on that. The two schools are leading the first national study on the health of same-gender couples. Associate Professor of Human Sciences at OSU, Claire Camp Dush, is the head of research for the first-of-its-kind study. She joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Tell us how this study works. Is it one of those longitudinal type of studies?
Well, not yet. Hopefully it will be eventually. But what we're doing is going to be recruiting about 2,000 couples spread across different gender and same gender couples. And I might mention about why I'm using that term same gender. Mm-hmm. I use that term because gender is determined by people individually. And so that's just a better term than using same sex, for example.
Okay. Yep.
But anyway, so it's going to be divided across same gender and different gender couples. And it'll be population representative, which is really cool. So it'll be couples from all over the United States. And we're working with Gallup to collect all of these data.
And how are you finding them?
So Gallup talks to about 300,000 people a month between random phone calls and letters. So everybody out there, if you get a letter from Gallup, open it up. There might be money in there. And then people respond to surveys, and we'll be recruiting from those individuals.
And you're looking for both gender couples, mm-hmm, and same gender couples.
Yeah, exactly.
For a control?
Right. And well, it's been since 1988 since we had a population representative study of U.S. families, which is ridiculous that it's been that long.
Yeah.
And so we're going to learn a lot, not only about same gender couples, but different gender couples as well, because the context of relationship has changed since 1988. So there's a lot that we can learn. We're going to have cohabiting couples and married couples in the sample.
Is there a hypothesis that you're going in with?
Well, our hypothesis, we know that sexual and gender minorities tend to have poorer health outcomes. And so our hypothesis is that it's the stress of that you experience in your daily life through like microaggressions and discrimination that might lead you to have poor health. And our idea is that family functioning or like the quality of your relationship might buffer some of those stressors. And so we're interested in seeing what do the quality of same gender relationships look like, married and cohabiting? Do they buffer against some of the stressors that same gender couples experience on a daily basis?
And when you're talking about those kind of just those stressors, that's the same thing that we talk about when we're talking about racial groups as well, any kind of minority group.
Yes. We're also going to have an oversample of racial and ethnic minorities because there's this idea of intersectional identities. So you might be a sexual and gender minority and a racial or ethnic minority, and that's kind of doubly stressful. So would that have a doubly stressful impact on your health or on your relationships or on your stress? And so with the fact that we're getting a population representative sample, we're actually be able to ask some of those questions, because most studies are community samples where you may not have a done in college towns, mm-hmm. so where you may not have a diverse sample, or they're population representative, but they're not oversampling for sexual and gender minorities, so you don't get enough numbers to really do much of have the power to really look at those questions.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a first-of-its-kind study that's getting underway to tell us more about the health disparities that same-gender couples, both just cohabitating and married couples, experience compared to the rest of the country. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. My guest is Claire Camp Dush. She's an associate professor of human sciences at Ohio State, which is collaborating with Bowling Green State University on this project. And why Bowling Green? Green and OSU, was that just a quirk of geography, or was it consciously done that way?
Well, it's interesting because we all, as Ohioans, think of the Ohio State University as our big flagship research university.
Yeah.
But actually, there's a lot of incredible research that goes on at other universities in the state of Ohio. And my colleague, Wendy Manning, who's at Bowling Green State University and who's my collaborator on this project, is one of the leading family demographers in the United States. In fact, she was just the president of our professional association, the Population Association of America. And they have an incredible group of family scholars at Bowling Green. And so it's geographically convenient, but also scientifically incredibly important to be working with them, and a privilege.
Why can't something like a census tell us a lot of the answers that you're seeking?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the census, well, first of all, with the new census forms, we will be able to identify same-gender couples. So that's a positive. So we'll be able to know if you're living with somebody who's your same gender. And this will be the first census where we will be asking it in a way that we're probably not going to get a lot of miscodes. So that's positive. But the census doesn't have detailed data on health outcomes. It doesn't have detailed data on relationship quality or conflict. It doesn't have detailed data on stress and microaggressions. So we're going to be getting much more detailed data. And I should also mention that we're not only getting self-report survey data, but people will complete time diaries. So we'll have time diary data as well, which is where you report on every activity that you did for a 24-hour period. And we'll get it on work days and non-work days. And we're going to try to get it from both members of the couples, so you can see how couples spend time together, how they spend time apart. And there's a lot we can learn from how people spend their time as well.
Have you speculated that if since marriage is now legal, same-gender marriage is legal in the United States, mm-hmm. that would reflect a better level of health?
Potentially. I mean, you would think that it
because
would
of
reduce,
healthcare and things like that.
Right. You would think it would reduce some of the discrimination. So it's possible. We're unfortunately not going to have the data to do a comparison, like before same gender marriage was legal in the U.S. Yeah. versus after. But what I can say is that we will also be able to get data on the state and regional climate, and even at your like census block group, the census groups the U.S. into smaller units of what the climate looks like for same-gender couples. So, for example, if your state has protections for same-gender couples, or if your state has a bill outlining transgender bathrooms, those are the kinds of things that we can look at policy context-wise to get at how context matters.
So you already know that their health, the health of whether they're cohabitating or married, of same-gender couples lags behind that of the larger population mm-hmm. in the United States. Do you have any kind of geographic breakdowns of that?
I'm not aware of any off the top of my head of being able to break that down geographically. I do think we have some at least preliminary evidence that your context does matter, and that if you live in a place that contextually has more discrimination,
that's
worse
wondering.
For your health.
So laws that ban who uses what bathroom.
Right, exactly.
Or restrict who uses what bathroom, that kind of a thing.
Right. Yeah. And I do think we have some evidence of that. But the reality is that same-gender couples live all over the United States, though we tend, you know, it's funny talking about the study. Same-gender couples are really low incidence in the population, which is why it's going to take us a while to get these data and because there's not a lot of them. But all of my friends are like, I know lots of same-gender couples. And I have to tell them, you guys all live in a bubble.
Yeah.
You know, in Columbus, we, you know, we have more than we might in like, you know, Chillicothe or whatever.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting to have talking with friends about the study.
Yeah, I know lots of people and they all seem perfectly healthy to me. The bubble, right? And what is the challenge of getting participants? I mean, money's one thing, but it's never that great.
Yeah. I mean, I think the real challenge right now is that people don't pick up their phones.
Yeah.
So if you want to get a population representative sample, it is getting more and more difficult because we used to just do, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you could buy a list of all of the people's phone number, all Americans' phone numbers, and you could randomly call them and they would probably pick up and you could try to, you know, talk to them and get information. Now, most people have cell phones. So even when you move to a cell phone frame, you can't call people necessarily on, you know, you're not allowed, I don't think you're allowed to do a random digit dial, like use a machine to call phone numbers for cell phones. It has to be an actual live person. And so that's difficult. And even if you do call them, people don't pick up their phones if they don't know the phone number calling, which is why
Because there's so much scam out there now.
Exactly. And that's why Gallup's starting to move to recruiting from an address-based sampling strategy as well. And I think they put like $2 to $5 in the envelope to try to incentivize people to return it.
I'm asking this. I think it's I saw an ad in the paper. I think I saw this on a OSU web, you know, the OSU internal news organ. But I also have seen ads in newspapers now for couples seeking couples for research. I don't think it was this, but I thought that was unusual and interesting.
It's not necessarily unusual, but we wouldn't do that because to get a population representative sample, we need to know who we're pulling our sample from. So that would be more of a convenient sample. So unfortunately, it's funny because another thing that it's been making me laugh is I've been getting emails from same-gender couples about the study. We'd be happy to be in your study, which would be amazing, but it's a random sample that we need to be able to wait to the population.
To
right.
Yeah.
So for population representative data, like we would wait like, let's say we had a black man who was in a same-gender relationship, we might weight his data more heavily than a white woman in a different gender relationship because he is less likely to be polled, right? So we can do things like weight data to be
represented. Because he's even a smaller sample.
Exactly.
Huh. And why now? What's the trigger for, you know, why pull the trigger on this now? What's the tipping point?
Well, there's something to be said for persistence. And so
I wish it would have been 20 years ago.
Well, no, I've been submitting this grant since 2015.
Okay.
And so it's been rejected a couple different times. And I just kept persisting and knew these questions were important. Now, I will say that what got funded was better than what I submitted four applications ago or five applications ago. But there is something to being able to survive rejection without going into complete shame. And my sister told me, what did she say? She said, if you're not getting rejected on a regular basis, you're not taking enough risks.
You're not trying enough. Yeah. Jessica in Columbus, you're on the air with Claire Camp Dush. She's an associate professor of human sciences at OSU, which is working on this study of same-gender couples. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
I was wondering if there's any evidence that kind of, or if there's any research or if your study's going to touch on bisexual individuals who might be in relationships with opposite sex individuals, if they are still impacted by these same health effects.
Hmm. Okay, that's a great question.
Bisexual, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let me say a few things about that. So first of all, you bring up a really good point, which is that your sexual identity is different from what kind of couple you're in. Mm. So you could be bisexual and being a different gender couple. You could be bisexual and being a same gender couple. And so we'll definitely be asking about sexual identity and how you identify separately from what kind of couple you're in. We're not assuming just because you're in a different gender couple that you're heterosexual, especially with the way that attitudes have changed about the ability for people to come out and feel like they are not going to be stigmatized. So secondly, we do know some about the health of bisexual individuals. And what's really interesting is that they have some of the worst health outcomes. And we're not exactly sure what's driving that. Hopefully the study could potentially shed some light on that. But the health outcomes of individuals that identify as bisexual tend to be worse than individuals that identify as heterosexual or homosexual.
When I asked you at the outset about longitudinal studies, mm-hmm. you said, "Hope not yet, but hopefully someday." Yeah. What's the road to that?
The road to that would be more grant submissions.
Okay.
This is funded by the National Institutes of Health. And so I was laughing yesterday that I'm probably going to have to start submitting this next year to get longitudinal data. But I'm thinking about trying to do like a 4-year follow-up, because then we want to see whose relationships survive, whose do not, whose health declines, who maintains their health, and how do all of those things work in concert. So we are definitely—
And compared to the larger population.
Exactly.
Right.
So we would definitely want this to be a population sample. And these data will become publicly available to scholars all over the world to use. This is not just something that we'll keep at Ohio State. Any family scholar or health scholar in the U.S. will be able to use these data eventually. And the longitudinal data will help with the utility of the data.
Here's a good question, I think, from Zach in Westerville. Hi, Zach. You're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking me.
You bet.
I was wondering if the study assessed to what degree people in same-gender relationships were out, like if they had come out to their families or their friends or their work, especially in like transgender same-gender relationships where, you know, if they may or may not be out or have just come out. I'm just curious if you assess that.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Zach, I'm working on the survey, and that sounds like a really great idea
something
that I should be asking about.
Talk about stressor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I don't know exactly. I'm sure that somebody someplace in the literature has asked some questions like that. But one thing I'm going to be working on over the next few weeks is putting together the survey and what questions do we want to get at. And I think that's a really great idea, something to assess.
Yeah. Thank you, Zach. Thanks for that call. Claire Camp Dush. I could sit and talk about this all day, but I've run out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Claire Camp Dush is an associate professor of human sciences at Ohio State, which is collaborating with folks at Bowling Green State University. They've been selected to lead the first national study on the health of same-gender couples, both cohabitating and married couples. We'll continue Wellness Wednesday when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When we all turned back our clocks a few weeks ago, we also started to see a spike in seasonal affective disorder. That's a type of depression that emerges when daylight wanes. Psychiatrist Dr. Susan Noonan wrote about how to manage those emotions in her new book, Take Control of Your Depression, Strategies to Help You Feel Better Now. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you for having me today.
Well, I know that I don't like it, that there's not as much sun out, but is that the same thing as seasonal affective disorder?
Well, a lot of people just don't like it and feel kind of grumpy around this time of year when we change the clocks back. But seasonal affective disorder is a little bit more than that. It's deeper and more involved for those who are affected by the change in sunlight.
It's just not a moody thing.
It's a form of depression.
Right. It's a physical thing, right?
Yes. It's a physical and a brain thing. Where there's a whole constellation of symptoms that a person would have, affecting their mood, affecting their sleep, their interest or pleasure in activities in life, their energy levels, their ability to think and concentrate, and their feelings of worthlessness or hopelessness and guilt suicidal thoughts.
Do we know if it affects some people or why it affects some people and not others? Or
that's a great question. I don't know that we really have that answer. Just like with major depression and with bipolar disorder, we believe it's a combination of a genetic predisposition along with something in the environment, such as a major stressor. In this case, the person is susceptible to the change in sunlight that happens, to the length of the exposure to light. And that combination sets up a perfect storm so that they react more negatively to that situation.
Are the symptoms of seasonal affective disorder necessarily different than, you know, could it be confused with for lack of a better phrase, garden variety depression?
They can be, but with seasonal affective disorder, it's clearly has a fluctuation with the time of year, mm-hmm. and a person may not then have symptoms in the middle of the summer or the springtime, whereas somebody who has depression would have symptoms throughout the year, on and off. So there's that would discriminate between the two.
Sometimes it's hard to imagine that an hour can make that much difference, but it does.
It does, certainly, and those who suffer from that can tell you for sure that it does make a difference.
You talk about defining our inner healthy self, and that's just kind of a self-awareness of what your moods are and how you are feeling, right?
Well, what it does is it tries to remind ourselves what we're like as a person, because sometimes when you have depression, you can't quite remember what you're really like. You kind of brush off the fact that you have skills and accomplishments in life, and it seems like depression is all that there is. Your baseline self seems to just fade into the background. So if you can hold on to the person that you really are, that you've been all along, then your underlying sense of who you are, then you can gather your lifelong coping resources to get you through the tough times in life, including that episode of depression that might be in front of you.
Like saying, you know what, this isn't me. I'm going to get some help.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
For some people, it kind of creeps up on you, right?
Yes. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between just having a blue day or a tough time and a stressful time and an episode that requires attention and treatment. And sometimes it's hard to know the difference between the two. And we're kind of conditioned in our society to just keep plugging along. Mm-hmm. And not just run to the doctor for every little thing. Life is full of ups and downs and stressors, and we try to manage them as best as we can. But if those downtimes last for 2 weeks or longer, or they really interfere with our life and our ability to function at work or school or in our social relationships, then it's really time to pay attention and get some professional help.
Some of us are more in tune than others. I went for years thinking that I got a cold at the exact same time every summer. until an allergist told me, no, you have leaf mold allergy.
Right.
Is it that kind of a thing?
It's easy to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is the treatment for seasonal affective disorder? If you've gone for that 2 weeks, you're not snapping out of it, you think that might be it, you seek help, you get counseling, what do they do?
Well, you know, counseling is talk therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes medication helps. Sometimes light therapy helps, where there's a light box, which is like the intensity of daylight that you would, a little box with like a light bulb that's the intensity of daylight that you would turn on in your home and sit near earlier in the day to expose yourself, your eyes absorb that light and it sends a signal to your brain to tell you, oh, it's daytime when it's really dark outside, and that can help some people. So it's a combination of treatments that's effective that one needs to pay attention to.
And is it helpful to, when you do seek professional help, to say, this is what I think it is, or do you just go in with an open mind? What do you recommend?
It's always good to have an open mind, but you need to be an active participant in your care. Mm-hmm. So it's good to give all the information that you can to your provider and to suggest, well, I think it might be such and so a diagnosis for the following reasons, and then give examples of everything that's going on in your life, concrete examples, and then leave it to the two of you to determine if, in fact, that is the diagnosis, putting the information together, acting like a detective, like Columbo, to pull it all together.
What about children? Do they experience the same way as adults do?
I don't know the data on children and seasonal affective disorder. Mm-hmm. I would think they probably did. Children are affected by depression,
mm-hmm.
And we know now with bipolar disorder. But I don't know the numbers for children, so I really cannot answer that question very adequately. I'm sorry for that.
No, that's okay. And does it matter? Is there a gender difference?
For depression, the data show that in the past have shown that women historically have been affected by it more than men. We've learned, however, that it may be that we're not capturing all the instances in men, mm-hmm. because men exhibit somewhat different symptoms than women for depression, whereas women more often experience the commonly known symptoms like sadness and tearfulness and trouble with sleep. Men become more irritable and agitated with angry outbursts. They might get into arguments and fights and punch a wall, drink heavily, drive fast, become workaholics. And that doesn't show up on the standard questionnaires, so we have to look more deeply into that. As far as seasonal affective disorder, I think they probably are affected by that in fairly equal numbers as well, if we ask the right questions.
If you don't get it treated, what's the difference? You just suffer through it? What do we know about letting it go, and then all of a sudden we spring forward again, and we get more, well, we lose light in another end of the day, but for a while.
Yeah, you do suffer through it. But then it becomes more difficult to treat, and it takes longer for the treatments that we have to work, longer for them to become effective, and then you're miserable for a longer period of time. So it's a little bit harder in that range. And then we know that the more often a person has a symptom, the more often they're going to get it down the road. So trying to prevent symptoms from recurring is the goal, and trying to keep them minimized and not the worst possible set of symptoms is also a goal.
If somebody thinks that they might be having a problem with a lack of sunlight in Ohio, in central Ohio, it's a particularly big problem. I mean, we have a lot of cloudy days in central Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
What can they do on their own if they want to figure out whether, is there a way to for them to figure out if that is what it is?
That's really hard to do on your own. It's a little trickier than trying to treat other illnesses on your own. It's really something that requires professional input to sort out, because it could be a lot of different things that could account for some of your symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one time I would suggest trying to get at least a consultation with some professional input.
What are some typical ways that people mistake what they're feeling and brush it off? You said a lot of times, you know, we have this in our society, we have that we're socialized to just brush it off, keep moving on. What might people, is there any advice you can give people for trying to become a little bit more self-aware about something like that?
Well, the most important thing is to just be aware of what you're normally like, and then any change in your usual patterns, change in your usual ability to relate to people, your usual patience with others, and if you're becoming more irritable, more fatigued, if it takes you longer to do any particular task, if you feel clumsier mentally as well as, you know, physically to do something, just any particular changes from your routine of the way you usually are, then that's something to pay attention to.
Does it help? Is it help to just talk to your spouse or your partner and ask them if they notice anything about you that's different?
That's very helpful, because sometimes you might be the last one to know that you're more irritable than usual, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So they can often give some good insight and help you try to make that decision on whether you need professional help or not, if they think something's going on as well, if you're not looking like your usual self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just as far as maybe just getting outside more as much as possible, taking a walk in the middle of the day, that kind of a thing?
Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's perfect. And it doesn't need to be for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
You could do a 15 or 20-minute walk at your lunch break and just walk around the block. It doesn't have to be a brightly sunny day, just getting out, even if it's overcast, and just getting out there and walk around will definitely help.
Do they find that more people in northern climates are affected by this because the days aren't shorter necessarily? Well, they're a little bit shorter maybe, but all things being equal, it's just they don't get out as much because of the climate?
That also contributes to it, yes, that's true.
So people in southern climates suffer from it at a lower rate than up here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Susan Noonan, I want to thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Ah, thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Susan Noonan. She's a psychiatrist and author of a new book. It's called Take Control of Your Depression, Strategies to Help You Feel Better Now. You can discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher and Wellness Wednesday as well. Check out WOSU.org/allsides. And from our website, you can listen and watch the show live on weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon. You can also explore the All Sides archive, which includes audio, video, and podcasts of every show. That's at WOSU.org/allsides. You listen to us from weekdays from 10 to noon for a show focused on the issues and events that shape life in Central Ohio. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Martin Coleman, welcome back, Kaylin Martin, Maisie Glockner, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.